Alone by Edgar Allan Poe. From childhood's hour I have not been, as others were I have not seen, as others saw I could not bring, my passions from a common spring. From the same source I have not taken, my sorrow I could not awaken, my heart's a joy at the same tone, and all I loved alone. Then, in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn from every depth of good and ill, the mystery which binds me still. From the torrent or the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me flying by, from the thunder and the storm and the cloud that took the form when the rest of heaven was blue, of a demon in my view.
Poem Alone, published in 1829. We'll take a look at some films that were inspired by his work coming up on this special Halloween edition of The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
할머니?
갑갑해요. 아가씨들은 어떻게 이러고 살아요?
이게 갑갑하다고?
아가씨, 저 죽어요!
We'll talk to Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook about his tense new erotic thriller, The Handmaiden. Plus,
look out the window of a suburban train in the east of Berlin, and you might see a lonely Ferris wheel protruding from the treetops.
In tribute to the horror classic Carnival of Souls, we'll take a terrifying wander through a real abandoned amusement park in Berlin. And a little later,
since nobody takes Duke home at night, he often creeps around the lobby at strange hours. As Hepburn says, he treats the entire building as his own personal kingdom.
What strange creature lurks in the dark of Melbourne's Astor Theatre? That's ahead on this special ghost-busting edition of The Cinema Show. Hello from the Grossmünster Church in the city centre of Zurich. I'm Ben Rylan. Halloween is almost upon us, and where better to start today's show than at a real haunted location? Legend has it that Zurich's patron saints, Felix and Regula, fled here to escape persecution by the Romans in the 3rd century, but they were quickly captured and gruesomely executed just nearby. It's said that shortly after their heads had been chopped off, their bodies rose to their feet, collected their severed remains, and carried them 40 paces to the top of a nearby hill. Now, it's on that very spot where I now stand, under the shadow of the magnificent Grossmünster Church. We'll have more frightful tales soon, but to start things off, we'll head to 1930s Korea, with one of the most fascinating voices working in cinema today. Park Chan-wook has developed quite a reputation for his films that tend to flirt with concepts of sexuality and danger. His latest film, The Handmaiden, is described as an erotic psychological thriller. It screened at Cannes earlier in the year and at London's recent film festival too. Monocle's Gaia Lutz sat down with Park Chan-wook to discuss how vengeance and sexual drama fuel his films.
할머니?
갑갑해요. 아가씨들은 어떻게 이러고 살아요?
이게 갑갑하다고?
A novel set in Victorian England may not seem like the most obvious choice for director Park Chan-wook's latest film. Published in 2002, Fingersmith by Sarah Waters was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's a much-loved title invoking scandal, thievery, and revenge, which might explain how the novel found its way to the Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook. Transplanting the action from old England to 1930s Korea, his adaptation, The Handmaiden, ripples with the kind of erotic tension that's almost come to define Park Chan-wook's style. Revenge plays such a striking role in so many of his films that I wondered how it might affect his relationship to his characters.
예, 제 영화에서 복수를 하려고 드는 사람들은 영웅은커녕.
In my films, those people who are seeking revenge, I depict them as not heroes, but rather as very pathetic people, very foolish people. However, all I am saying is that even for these people, there are aspects about them that we can understand and that we can sympathize with. This is because anyone can see very easily that an act of revenge, engaging in that business of vengeance, is the most foolish act there is in the world, because you are trying to bring back what cannot be brought back. And certainly, for engaging in such foolish business, these people cannot be heroes. But in terms of why, despite this, they engage in such business, as human beings, we can understand, we can sympathize with them. There's something human about that.
There are so many dynamics at play in The Handmaiden. Whether it's the male-female collision of the characters or the delicate reverberations between old Korea, Japan, and the Western world. Given its Victorian origins, I wondered why it was important to explore these three worlds in the film.
1930년을 시대 배경으로 하고 있는데 이때는 한반도가
This film is based in Korea in the 1930s. During this time, the Korean peninsula is yet to be divided between the north and the south. The reason I have a special interest in this period is because this is the period in Korean history where modernism made its way into Korea. What's very particular to Korea in terms of how it was modernized is that the doors to Korea were forced open by the Imperial Japanese. And it was through the Japanese that modernism entered into Korea, and with it, Western culture. Science and technology, they all made their way into Korea, filtered through the Japanese.
서양의 문명 그리고 과학과 기술 이 모든 것이 일본을 통해서 들어간다.
The Handmaiden has been described as an erotic thriller. Of course, the film is filled with sexual tension and sensuality. For Park Chan-wook, grasping the core of the characters was all about keeping his gaze close to home.
남자가 나이를 먹어 간다는
Men growing in old age is the process during which they discover the feminine side within themselves and learn to embrace it without feeling embarrassed by it. And especially since the marriage to my wife gets longer and longer by the year and my daughter gets older, I get to experience more conversations with them. Looking back, the origin of this could be found in Joint Security Area when I turned the investigator character into a female. It's around that time that it all began, through my past films like Lady Vengeance, Thirst, and especially Stoker, which is all about a female protagonist coming of age, I think gradually I got to discover and embrace the female perspective.
Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook discussing his latest thriller, The Handmaiden. He was talking to Monocle's Guy Lutz. If you're anything like me, it's around this time of year that you start to ponder which classic horror film to revisit that might best set the Halloween mood. The one I always turn back to tends to be The Innocents, the classic British horror film from 1961 that exploits our fear of the dark to create a brilliant atmosphere and frighten its audience to tears. There's also Dracula, Frankenstein, or the incredible special effects masterpiece The Invisible Man. But when it comes to gothic horror, there's perhaps one gentleman who's most likely contributed more to the world of film than just about anyone else, and without ever living in the era of the moving picture. I speak, of course, of Edgar Allan Poe.
Suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. Open then, I flung the shutter. When with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven.
The voice of Dracula himself, Bela Lugosi, in the 1934 film adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's best-known work, The Raven. Despite reaching an early grave nearly half a century before the dawn of cinema, the work of Poe has provided filmmakers with some of the most enduring horror legends. According to IMDb, there have been exactly 337 films or television series based upon the works of Poe. From the 1909 short film simply titled Edgar Allan Poe, made by the great D.W. Griffith, to the much-loved B-movie classics starring the likes of Boris Karloff and, of course, Vincent Price.
Madeline and I are like figures of fine glass. The slightest touch and we may shatter.
That's him in House of Usher from 1960, a supreme choice for Halloween viewing. Poe wrote it as a short story in 1839, which was said to be based on the real-life story of a woman who had been carrying on an affair in the cellar of her house in Boston. When her husband discovered what had been transpiring, he entombed her and her man in their favourite spot. Their bodies were discovered, embracing each other years later as the house was torn down.
You really believe this?
Evil is not just a word. It is a reality. Like any living thing, it can be created and was created by these people.
The characters haunting the House of Usher wander perilously through this picture, knowing that they're close to the end of their family line, or perhaps the end of their lives. Tim Burton took that cue and placed it in the mind of a young boy with an overactive imagination in his first short film, Vincent, from 1982, narrated, of course, by, well, I'll let you guess.
Vincent Malloy is 7 years old. He's always polite and does what he's told. For a boy his age, he's considerate and nice. But he wants to be just like Vincent Price.
We remember Poe for his brilliantly dark descriptions of haunted worlds and lost souls, suffering under the weight of loss and regret. It's a reputation fostered by the films of Vincent Price and the director Roger Corman, but it also meant that Poe was often ostracized during his lifetime. Those drawn to his work by his intuitive talent for illustrating nightmares would also shun the writer for raising such an impolite topic. And yet he also dabbled in other realms, often to great effect. In the final year of his short life, he wrote a poem called Eureka, which described the existence of the universe as a series of particles differing in size which, by orbiting around each other, formed the physical universe. Poe had no motive for grasping any of this other than his own personal observations and reasoning. It's an astonishing achievement for someone who was largely uneducated and often attracted the dismissal of his peers. But the art of dying always proved most fascinating to Poe. And while his stories are fondly remembered for their macabre detail, death seen through his eyes was something less grotesque. Where there was morbidity, there was always romance, be it the courting of one's mortality or the yearning for something more. As he wrote in the opening lines of To One in Paradise, "Thou wast all that to me, love, for which my soul did pine, a green isle in the sea, love, a fountain and a shrine, all wreathed with fairy fruits and flowers, and all the flowers were mine." If all that has whet your appetite for some gothic horror, MUBI has programmed a delicious Halloween double bill for listeners in the US. Keep an eye out for the Italian film Your Vice is a Locked Room on the night before Halloween, followed by the film version of the story it was based upon, The Black Cat. And if you're in the United Kingdom, get set for a flashback to the 90s with the original Scream, followed by two of its sequels. Head to MUBI.com/monocle for a frightening taster. Still to come, we'll visit an abandoned amusement park in tribute to the 1962 horror classic Carnival of Souls. Plus, what lurks in the darkness of Melbourne's Astor Theatre? Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think,
absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're listening to a special Halloween edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from the Grossmünster Church in Zurich. One of the best reasons for spending Halloween in this magnificent Swiss city, aside from the wonderful assortment of creepy old buildings, is, of course, the trick-or-treating. You're almost certain to walk away with a bucket full of Swiss chocolate. We were talking a little earlier about which films to revisit over the Halloween weekend, be it the Scream films from the 90s, or one of the many works based upon the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. But there's another film I simply can't go past at this time of year. In the early 1960s, Herc Harvey was involved in the production of industrial films when he found himself driving past an abandoned amusement park. The strange sight of the deathly quiet carnival gave him the idea for what would become a cult classic, 1962's Carnival of Souls.
This used to be quite a place. It's been deserted for a long time now.
Will you take me in?
My goodness, no. It isn't safe out there anymore. That's why they put up this barrier.
It'd be very easy to step around it.
What attraction could there be for you out there?
If you've ever been to an abandoned amusement park, you'll likely understand why it might have affected Harvey so profoundly. And it's something residents of Berlin have known for quite some time, as our fearless contributor, Katty Krauss, discovered.
Look out the window of a suburban train in the east of Berlin, and you might see a lonely Ferris wheel protruding from the treetops. Not many Berliners would be able to tell you where it stands exactly, or why, or that it's haunted. So we will. The Ferris wheel belongs to Spreepark, an amusement park which was closed 15 years ago and has since lain abandoned, its rides decaying slowly. Spreepark was originally called Kulturpark Plenterwald. It was the GDR's only theme park, opened in 1969 and attracting millions of visitors every year. In 1991, it was privatized and turned into a Western-style amusement park. Yet from the start, the newly named Spreepark was beset by planning and financial problems. In 2001, it finally closed, amidst accusations and scandals, including a cocaine-filled flying carpet that would obsess the yellow press for years. But that is not what Christopher Flade remembers of Spreepark. Since 2003, the 28-year-old from West Berlin has been running a website with the largest known archive of information and photos of Spreepark. He's given 739 tours of the abandoned park, by his count. And recently, he and some others produced a film about Spreepark, with 6 hours of bonus material. Let's put it this way. His fan credentials are flawless, and as a man afraid of heights, he doesn't even particularly like amusement parks.
I really liked going as a kid. I loved the place. I went a lot with my parents. I fell in love a little with the children's program. Two clowns, Hops and Hopsy, who were in charge of the children's stage for 10 years. I went there for the first time at the age of 4 and actually liked the clowns better than the park itself. But since I always visited them, I was in the park and observed a lot, all the changes. I must admit that as I became friends with the old couple, I got free tickets. Otherwise, I don't think we would have been able to afford to go 40 or 50 times a year.
See? Flawless. But what Christopher remembers most clearly about Spreepark is its aura, its mood, which was exceptional even before it was abandoned.
What I found so beautiful about the park and always remember is the special atmosphere. It lies in the middle of a forest, and that long path through the forest is something that, of course, you perceive differently as a child. There's anticipation. You know you'll be on the roller coaster soon. but first you have to walk through this forest, and then the rides, the roller coaster, and the Ferris wheel protrude from the forest or run between the treetops. That was something unique, something special. A lovely atmosphere. It was a lot of fun.
Christopher has of course witnessed just how fascinated people have become with the abandoned park. And unlike Spreepark's security guards or management, he says he understands the attraction. Christopher's visited other famous abandoned places around Berlin, like the former hospital in Belitz or the CIA surveillance station at Teufelsberg. But since they would hold few good childhood memories for most people, the contrast between those colorful memories and the spooky reality is less extreme. And the reality, he says, is very spooky.
It's still fascinating that it's in the middle of a forest. Today, what didn't used to be a forest is turning into one. Nature is taking it back. Everything is still in its place. The 45-meter Ferris wheel is still there, squeaking and turning slowly in the wind. The roller coaster is still standing, with trees growing between the rails. The white water ride has been drained and dried, so it's very dusty and full of spiderwebs. Everything is still there and is turning into wilderness ever more. It's very eerie, very fascinating, very unique.
In
1979, an East German children's TV series, The Haunting of the Ferris Wheel, was shot in Spreepark. Not much later, another related story of haunting began, this one in Hamburg. In 1981, the fairground ride owner Norbert Witte was involved in Germany's deadliest post-war fairground accident to date, when a crane heat setup collided with a neighboring ride, killing 7 people. 10 years later, the Witte family won the bid for Spreepark, which they refurbished extensively. But in 2001, they filed for bankruptcy. The details are murky and contested. What we know is that the family then emigrated to Peru, several fairground rides in tow. Yet their luck didn't improve. In 2004, customs officials discovered 167 kilograms of cocaine hidden in a ride that was being shipped to Germany. And both Norbert Witte and his son went to prison. Christopher Flader knows every detail of this haunted story of Spreepark, but he isn't interested in gossip. All he cares about is the park itself, which Norbert Witte was rumored to want to revive after he was released from prison in 2008. Nothing came of it. Last year, after much to and fro, the Berlin state bought the park and plans to turn it into a natural preserve. Christopher wishes they'd at least leave the Ferris wheel. Not as an eerie, squeaking monument to a haunted past, but as a running ode to joy.
Thank you, Catty. Now, it's nearly time for this special Halloween edition of The Cinema Show to join the dearly departed, but before we take our final breath, we'll touch down in Melbourne for a spot of paranormal investigation. The Astor Theatre will take a detour from its regular lineup over the Halloween weekend for a special collection of frightening features. It's sure to strike fear into the most hardened members of the audience, especially considering how spooky the Astor's old auditorium can be. Over the past 2 decades, people have witnessed a strange presence moving through the room. Apparently, the entity can appear at any moment, and has even been known to show up midway through a screening. To get to the bottom of what's going on, we sent Monocle's very own Ghostbuster, Adrian Craddock, to investigate.
The Astor Theatre in Melbourne is not your average cinema. Opened in 1936, the place is a perfect example of Art Deco grandeur. Chandeliers hang from the ceilings, the lobby has a marble floor, and the seats in the auditorium are made from fine green leather. Cult classics, documentaries and independent films make up the bulk of the programming. But every now and again, famous horror movies such as Psycho or The Silence of the Lambs also make it onto the bill. During these screenings, it's not uncommon for audience members to experience something kind of weird. In the middle of a climactic scene, they'll observe a strange shape moving through the chairs. It ducks and weaves without making a sound. What is this mysterious force? Is it a ghost or an evil spirit? No, it's the fairy tale of Duke, the Astor's resident cat. Duke has been living at the Astor since 2015. He's not the first animal to call the cinema home. The Astor actually has a long history of resident felines. Probably the most famous inhabitant was an affectionate stray called Marzipan, who stalked around the cinema from 1992 to 2013. Marzipan was so beloved by patrons that when she died, there were a lot of questions about whether she could ever be replaced. It was only when Zach Hepburn became the cinema's new manager that a decision was made. He was determined to keep the Astor's feline tradition going, so he reached out to a local animal shelter and adopted Duke.
So we had almost like a cat interview with him. We went and had a little meeting with him at the shelter and wanted to make sure that he wasn't going to be too frightened by crowds. And he was an incredibly docile animal. His name was originally Tarantino when he was adopted.
I'm surprised he didn't keep that name. Did that ever come on the cards? Or?
I just feel that Tarantino's, it's a little bit too on the nose about being a reference. We wanted to keep it in the tradition of being a film reference, but we wanted to be a little bit more subtle. So he's such a big cat. He's actually a Norwegian forest cat. So we thought, what's an emblematic Hollywood actor who is big in stature? And we thought, well, John Wayne. And his nickname obviously was Duke. So that's why we've called the cat the Duke.
Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth.
Hepburn can still recall the first day he introduced Duke into the cinema. He says it didn't take long for him to make himself at home.
He was obviously very timid when he came in, and I think as all cats do, they find the furthest corner in the building or in the space that they're in, and they go and hide in it for about a day. So he picked one of the couches upstairs to sort of position himself behind. But look, he was always very, very open to the space. He's a bit of an explorer in that regard, and you put him in a space and he'll go and walk through it. So really only after a day he was up and around getting photos taken, and sometimes he gets a little bit concerned about the noise, but he'll always just kind of sit there solitary and look off into the distance and just acknowledge that it's happening but never run away from it.
Since nobody takes Duke home at night, he often creeps around the lobby at strange hours. As Hepburn says, he treats the entire building as his own personal kingdom.
Essentially, this is his house, so he interacts with people as he pleases. So he'll come and sit on their lap sometimes. He'll offer a little bit of a neck rub or a leg rub on their thighs. And other than that, he just sort of is living his dream at the Astor Theatre. And people are very, very gracious. They always make sure that, if he doesn't look like he wants to be touched or bothered at that time, they'll let him have his space. But no, this is his home. And, as a guest in his home, people are very, very accommodating.
Duke's confidence never seems to bother any of the patrons, but he does have one slightly annoying habit. Below the screen at the Astor is an old Hammond organ, which used to be played during films. Duke does this thing where he just walks across it at random times. It can cause a bit of a racket. Still, Duke has already managed to gain quite a profile in Melbourne. He's got a cohort of fans and has inspired a film festival that revolves around cat videos. A few months ago, he was even profiled by a local magazine. The article went into all kinds of details about Duke's daily life and also explained that he strongly prefers celluloid film over digital. When I asked Hepburn about this detail, he said it was true.
Well, essentially, the Astor is home to celluloid. We champion ourselves on presenting films on 35mm film and 70mm film when everywhere else is predominantly digital nowadays. So I think in keeping with Duke's fascination with all things culture and class, he does seem to be a little bit more receptive to the 35mm. I personally think it's just because he likes to jump in the boxes that the film prints have come out of prior to them being shown. But yeah, he's very much a celluloid cat. He's not a digital cat.
It's clear from the way Hepburn speaks that he sees Duke as more than just a pet. It's almost as if the cat is a symbol of the Astor's welcoming atmosphere. He's part of a tradition. He's part of the family.
I think the Astor is a venue that people connect with because there's so much heart and personality to it. It's not just a regular building that you go and see a film in. So Duke is emblematic of that. This is a cat who, you know, over a year ago was displaced, had no home, and now is on to the next part of one of his nine lives. So I feel that there's this fantastic sort of community spirit that the Astor has, and it's adoration for second chances. And that's exactly what Duke is emblematic of. For us, the Astor is a community venue, and it's something that I think Duke really belongs in.
Thank you to the very brave Adrian Craddock there, who no one would dare call a scaredy cat. Well, it is time to put the final nail in our show's coffin for this week. However, we will rise again next week for a very special audio tour of Los Angeles as we celebrate the release of Monocle's new travel guide. Today's show was edited by Kieran the Cannibal Banerjee and researched by the ghoulish Yolene Goffin. Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic is written by Ben Pobgy and performed by Barney Burnham. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Happy Halloween.